I know many of our listeners who are big readers will recognize the name Emma Donoghue. She's an Irish author now based in Canada. Her smash hit novel was Room a few years ago. It was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize based on that dreadful story of Joseph Fritzl, who held a woman captive and gave birth to children with her in Austria. You might remember that it was made into a movie, which won an Oscar for Brie Larson in the lead role. Huge success for her. It's not that novel I want to talk about today, though. It's the new one, and it's a completely, completely different kettle of fish. Her 13th novel is called The Pull of the Stars, and it was actually rushed to early release because it is so very, very topical right now. It is set in the midst of a global pandemic. The novel takes place in inner city Dublin in 1918 over the course of a couple of days, largely set in a public hospital, which is buckling under the weight of patients and staff who are suffering from the Spanish flu. And of course, the hospital already under-resourced because of the impact of World War I, which continues to rage. There is also the lingering memory of the Irish uprising against British rule. That happened 2 years prior to this book and is very, very much part of the plot as well. I absolutely, absolutely loved it. There have been a few books and authors I've spoken about this year that I haven't enjoyed that much, but this is not one of them. I read it cover to cover in 2 days flat. If you enjoyed Call the Midwife as a series, you're going to love this. It's a very similar setting in a midwifery ward. If you like the TV series or the novel, I think you will enjoy this. It focuses not only on the arrival of the babies and the impact of the flu, but also on the abysmal living conditions and how those contribute to the health issues of the day. So it was my great pleasure to speak to the author last week. Time differences to Canada, just impossible for this show, so we had to pre-record it, but I was happy to catch up with her on Zoom. This is me chatting to Emma Donoghue.
Okay. Emma, I know you began writing this book in late 2018. The world had not yet even heard a whisper of the concept of COVID-19. So before we talk about how COVID changed the book, what was the original motivation for you for tackling the issue of maternal health during a pandemic?
Well, I suppose it was the centenary of the Great Flu pandemic that caught my eye. I read an article about it in The Economist magazine. And I suppose I had always known about the flu vaguely, but it's so overshadowed by World War One. You know, if it had happened in say 1925, I think it would have really stood out. But really, as just one of the many, many horrors of that long global conflict, it tends to be completely forgotten. So I'd never really paid it close attention before. And as soon as I started reading a few books about it, one little fact that caught my eye was that women in late pregnancy were the most likely to get it and to suffer side effects. And I thought that was so interesting because of its focus on women's bodies. I suppose we're so used to thinking of, you know, if you say a word like 1918, you immediately think of young, suffering men cut down. So also I thought that the focus on women would be a very interesting way of sort of recentering things, because a maternity ward would have to be a space absolutely dominated by women, in which women were, you know, working in both ways, laboring to give birth and laboring in a different sense to help the other women give birth. So I thought it would be an irresistible space for a novelist, in that it would be rather like the trenches, but for women, you know, a space of horror and fear and work and suffering, but also instant camaraderie and intense bonding, and even a kind of a, you know, a kind of a thrill to the you know, the fighting of death. So yeah, that's what drew me in, and it had nothing to do with COVID. Yes, I finished the final draft of the novel on March 3rd this year before I ever heard about COVID. So it's very extraordinary how relevant it is to COVID. Just because I think if you pay close attention to any pandemic, those same issues are going to come up, you know?
Reading this book in the current time, in the midst of a pandemic, it was eerie. The signs you describe on hospital walls, the advice that they are sharing with patients to cough into the elbow, to wash their hands, often to social distance without using that term. I mean, it felt eerily prescient, although, as you've just told us, that wasn't the intention. But having said that, there you sit with a finished draft on the 3rd of March, and all of a sudden the world around you has basically become the setting of your book. Did that change the way the book was handled? Did they move it through the process more speedily than would otherwise have happened?
Yes, when they were postponing a lot of other books, and they rushed mine forward. Now, you know, they didn't publish it in too quick or slapdash away. They still put it through the same rigorous two layers of copy editing. And my editors had all edited it the previous year, so nothing was rushed, but they just, you know, they let me jump the queue. And I felt extremely sheepish about this. I felt it was a time of international crisis and, you know, I didn't want to be seen to be profiting from it. But I had to agree that it made sense as a context for this novel. So I've been really glad to have been able to be part of the conversation about things like, you know, social injustice and how it contributes to pandemics and, you know, healthcare workers and their astonishing, you know, courage and humor and energy and stamina. So it's been actually a really lovely experience to publish it this year.
I'm so glad you mentioned the issue of the social injustice. Of course, it's something we're grappling with here in South Africa because we've got such a diverse society. One household's ability to lock down and take their school lessons on Zoom and socially distance from one another is a completely removed reality for another household. So there are issues, I think, that South African readers are going to read into this book that are going to ring true because of that context. I also think, I mean, I've the whole way reading it, I had playing through my head snapshots of the TV series and the books called The Midwife, which are set in a different time, but also ring so true with not only the storytelling of what women go through giving birth, but also the theme of how poverty and lack of access to good health care and social discrepancies plays into women's health. I'm sure a lot of listeners who love that series will see that.
And coming from Ireland, you know, the theme of childbirth in women's lives looms very large for me because Ireland has been a bizarrely pronatalist culture. I mean, we were one of many Catholic European nations, but way past the point where everybody else was, you know, reducing their birth rate. Irish women just kept pumping them out and it became part of, you know, specifically Irish pride and working class pride and Catholic pride and, you know, a way of showing that your marriage was a good one, you know? So, I mean, my parents, you know, had eight of us and luckily they plenty of food and so on. So my mother, you know, survived to almost 90. But I was really aware that it was too much to ask of women that they just keep pumping out children forever. And I've really enjoyed motherhood, but I've only had two, and under ideal conditions.
Yeah.
So I think yes, I really wanted to focus on the question of how a pandemic is not random at all. A pandemic hits those hardest who we have already agreed to have in a position of weakness. You know, whether through racializing them or through keeping them poor. I mean, in Canada, we're, we tend to see these things through a lens of racism. Like if you look at a map of Toronto, the areas that have been hardest hit are those with most racialized people. But in Ireland in 1918, I would say exactly the same thing was happening at the level of class. So it's dispiriting, isn't it? That whatever it is that causes us to label people as the other, you know, it can be completely arbitrary and yet the same dynamics of, you know, keep them cooped up in unhealthy conditions and then blame them when they get sick. Say they've got, you know, pre-existing conditions or unhealthy habits.
It's bizarre. And as you say, it's how depressing that we're having this conversation in 2020 that would have been relevant 100 years ago. And we don't seem to have gotten any further in progressing away from that. I mean, I love one of your doctors in the book, when they're engaging with how do I capture the cause of death on this death certificate and wanting to write too many children or she was worn down by life. You know, you really felt those words. You took us straight into the heart of it. You write in the author's note at the end of the book, Emma, that this book is fiction pinned together with facts. And obviously, as we've referenced, the facts being those of the pandemic that happened in 1918 and the millions of lives that were lost. And most of the characters are made up characters. But talk to us about some of the actual historical sources that you drew on in creating the sense of place and creating those characters.
Sure. I used a lot of not just other historians' books about, say, the flu in Ireland or midwifery training or hospitals in Ireland, but I also found it very helpful to pick up the kind of tone of those early sources. So one of my most useful books was a manual for midwives written by an Irish doctor in 1910. And his tone is so tetchy and, you know, warning. He will give some detailed diagram of the reproductive system. And then he'll say, don't allow any of this knowledge to go to your head and that you start making decisions. You know, I'm only telling you this so that you will know when to run for the doctor. You know, he was clearly terrified that too much knowledge would cause these nurses and midwives to start behaving, you know, the way nurses and midwives do nowadays with a lot more authority, a lot more confidence. So, sources like that are almost as useful for their tone as for the actual information in them. And I also had to research all the medical stuff two ways, you know. I would use modern sources to try and get a really accurate sense of what was going on in terms of, say, an inflammatory response or high blood pressure, because always there was the pregnancy and the pregnancy and the flu. And sometimes I got really muddled about, hang on, the flu would be doing this to her blood pressure and the pregnancy would be doing that. So I would use modern sources, and then I would say to myself, what did they know in 1918? And I would strip it away and say, oh, they didn't know about the immune system. Okay. And they didn't have antibiotics, and their oxygen machines were really no use yet. So bring all that away. And mostly what was left was watch and wait, which of course meant basic nursing was all the more important, because there was no medical savior coming in. There was nothing doctors could offer beyond, you know, aspirin, quinine, or hot whiskey for comfort.
I mean, yeah, you read the first time the doctor says, give her some whiskey, and you sort of think, what? Sorry, what did he just prescribe? But as you say, that's what they had. I mean, your book is set at a point in which they haven't even yet discovered the flu virus. So it's very rudimentary understanding of what is going on in the body as the flu happens, let alone what's going on with the delivery of the children. And some of the procedures detailed in this book are horrifying to even imagine that could once have been standard medical practice. And even more horrifying is to read your comment at the end that some of them were still in use right up into the middle of the 20th century. It's quite, for the squeamish, it's tough enough to read them, but to digest that they carried on sawing open pubic bones, for example. Did you know that beforehand? I mean, did you expect any of that?
No, you know, I only came across that in my last wave of research, because quite often, you know, you do lots of research in advance when you're writing historical fiction and you do a first draft, but then questions arise, or my agent might say, you know, why didn't they try oxygen? And then I would do lots more research, like what was the state of, you know, oxygen giving in those days? So quite late on, I found myself confronting the issue of, you know, would they be likely to do a cesarean if a baby was getting stuck? And I look it up and I find, no, in Ireland, they had this special operation called a pubiotomy or a symphysiostomy, where they would unhinge the pubic bone. I was like, what is this nightmare we're in? Yeah. But it turns out that if your main aim was to keep women pumping out babies, this was, you know, technically the best operation to use, because you can't do multiple cesareans, the uterus will rip, you know. So in the warped Handmaid's Tale world of Ireland, you know, this was the best operation to use. So you have to almost put your mental, your modern mental blinkers aside and say, this made sense in its day. However, even back then, I think many people would have had reason to be nervous of this operation. So I decided I would raise it as a specter. I would have a young doctor be on the point. He's going off to get his chainsaw, basically. Chainsaws were invented for this purpose, little hand-wound chainsaws. He's going off to get his chainsaw, but she manages to get the baby out another way. Yeah, I thought a lot about how much my readers could take. And I knew I had to be sort of very realistic and unsparing in my depictions of childbirth. I mean, you can't describe childbirth euphemistically, especially unless people have given birth, they've no reason to know these details. So you can't just assume they'll know the way you might with something like a gunshot to a stomach. You know, we've all seen that in so many films, but with, you know, questions of whether the cervix is opening or not, you can't rely on people's general knowledge. So I had to be explicit, but I also had to give my readers enough moments of uplift, you know. So I thought a lot about the tonal balance and, you know, how many would live and how many would die.
Emma, the one character who is an actual historical character in this book is the wonderful Dr. Kathleen Lynn. And I mean, a rarity in every sense. There she comes into a hospital in 1918. You have a qualified female doctor, which is unusual to start with, let alone one who is so forthright in speaking her mind on social justice issues, let alone one who's politically active. Tell us a little bit more about this woman.
Sure. I wasn't looking for any real historical characters to put in this book, because the pandemic was a detailed enough set of facts for me to work with. But when I was researching doctors in Ireland circa 1918, very quickly I encounter Kathleen Lynn, who was the chief medical officer of Sinn Féin. So she was, you know, a revolutionary. She'd been to jail for her part in the 1916 Rising. She was, the government would have seen her as, you know, a completely dangerous person to have roaming around. And she was on the run from the police during the time of the novel, but she was also running a flu clinic, because that was her mindset, you know, that you don't hide away at home just because you happen to be in danger of arrest. You know, you do good. She was a vicar's daughter. She got into, basically concern for the poor, welfare work, and then feminism, and then nationalism, as a kind of, you know, the ripples of do-gooding, I suppose, moving outwards. She was like, I must look after the poor. You know what? I must look after women. You know what? Our entire country needs to be better run. So she was a remarkably humane and interesting character. And luckily, she got to have quite a role once Ireland did found its own state. She brought in the tuberculosis vaccine, for instance. And she just had such a curious scientific mind, you know, doing autopsies, you know, looking and looking for the bacterium, which, of course, we now know was a virus and much smaller, and they wouldn't have been able to see it.
Yeah.
So she was just an absolutely remarkable figure, and I couldn't keep her out of the book. I tried to keep her fictional at first. You know, I gave her a fictional name, and I tried to leave out many of the political details, but then my agents all said, tell us more about the revolution.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to allow a character to step forward into the light.
And she's, I mean, it seems quite appropriate that she didn't just step forward. She leaped forward and grabbed a big chunk of the book, because it was fascinating to read, as somebody who doesn't know a lot about Irish history, to read the background of the 1916 rebellion, which plays very much into your 1918 story. I found absolutely fascinating. And to know then reading, you know, I wanted to know more about her. The first thing I did after finishing the book was go and look her up. And, you know, there fine, she went on to serve in Parliament. And so just a wonderful character. Equally, though, although this is a book dominated by women, there is one male figure who is there continuously in the background, and that's the brother of your nurse, who has come home from the war shell-shocked and literally has lost his voice and lost his ability to speak. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about your thinking around that character, because, as you say, we think of 1918, you immediately think of those figures, of the men traumatized and killed on the front. You don't often, you know, see them back in normal life afterwards. So many of the movies and books that we read, that they're killed on the front or they're back, with obvious exceptions like The Good Soldier. But talk to us a little bit more about that character.
Sure, sure. I mean, I never wanted to ignore the war, but I wanted to keep it in the background. So I wanted to find ways in which it would slightly haunt the novel. So I thought, for instance, one of the orderlies should have a half metal face. And then I thought, okay, I don't want Julia living in a busy nurse's residence with lots of other characters. You know, I wanted her to have a different home life. And I, you know, I looked up the census to see where nurses lived, and some of them lived with, say, a brother. And I thought, oh, I like that idea, especially as it would form a kind of alternative family. And then I thought, if he's back from the war, that would be a lovely way to evoke the war without bringing it into the spotlight. And I was looking at all the ways in which he could be damaged, from the classic kind of one leg to scarring and so on. And then I came across the notion that some of them were mute from trauma. And I thought that was a lovely one, because his silence would be very eloquent. Mm-hmm. And I liked the idea that, in fact, he has all sorts of skills and powers, and he's actually extremely nurturing and a stable element for his sister, even though he's damaged. I suppose the idea of the mute soldier has come up in other books, like, say, by Pat Barker, her Regeneration trilogy, but the focus is on his damage, whereas I liked the idea that I could actually focus on what he has left, you know, what he's getting on with. And you know, the fact that he's mute means he's never making any big statements about it, but he's making life choices. He's growing vegetables. He's buying a cake. He's tending a magpie. So he ended up being one of my favorite characters, and it was a lovely challenge to create a character without any dialogue, and just kind of, you know, suggest a sensitivity in his response to things.
He's also a lovely foil to Bridie, and we can't not mention Bridie, because such a wonderful character, and she's the young volunteer who arrives to help. As I would have mentioned going into the interview, Julia, the nurse, finds herself unexpectedly in charge, and on her own in charge of a fever ward.
Understandable mistake. Yes, a maternity fever.
Membrane, sorry. But so Bridie comes from a position of having no family. She is a ward of an orphanage of sorts, and a very miserable life that she's led there, and yet brings this beautiful spirit of just rolling up her sleeves and getting on with it and helping and learning along the way. Talk to us a little bit more about deliberate, that you have this lovely, although small, nurturing, loving, caring bond between Julia and her brother, and juxtapose against that Bridie who has nobody to go home to at the end of the day.
You always need conflict one way or another, but I found with this novel that if you have enough external conflict, if you have, you know, shortages and the terror of invasion and the pandemic, you can actually afford to have your characters treat each other very gently and graciously. because you don't need, you know, to be picking fights. There's already, they're all fighting with death, as it were.
Yeah.
So, yeah, early on, for logistical reasons, I decided Julia needs a helper, because I'm looking at the instructions for how to change the bed clothes while you've got a patient in the bed. And I'm thinking, you simply can't do that single-handed. Even though nurses were expected to do all sorts of things that nowadays would be done by others, like, you know, brewing up beef tea. They did quite a lot of making, you know, invalid food. I don't know how they fitted it in. But anyway, I thought she needs a helper. And because we have doctors and nurses, I thought I want somebody at the absolute bottom of the power spectrum in a hospital. So an untrained volunteer who, you know, the fact of the pandemic would provide opportunities for somebody like her who'd never be usually let in the door. And then I thought, well, if she's coming into this hospital, which is a clearly an institution that is doing a lot of good and helping the poor for free, it would be interesting if she was from one of the many institutions that had a much darker side. And Ireland has really been reckoning with its past of institutionalizing a very big percentage of its population. In, you know, mother and baby homes, so-called Magdalen hospitals for fallen women, and orphanages, industrial schools, reformatories. You know, these were really a set of penal institutions. For instance, you might say if a woman was pregnant and wasn't married, it was great that there was somewhere she could go and give birth for free. But actually, she might have to stay on and work for 2 years to pay off her debt to the nuns. So I decided if Bridie was a product of that system, it would make a much more interesting sort of study of, you know, the pros and cons of these welfare institutions. And also, I knew there would be babies born in the hospital who might be facing a life in an orphanage. So again, bringing Bridie in, it was a further way of sort of, you know, probing the notion of the Irish family as having many people who didn't fit into it in the traditional way. So you have Julia, you know, facing spinsterhood, but she and her brother are really a very kind of, you know, mutually nurturing pairing. And Bridie really with no home life, but with a kind of natural reserve of energy and curiosity and intelligence, which just hasn't been used so far. I suppose one thing I was trying to get at with Bridie was that, you know, women have often been underutilized, or rather their energy is used, but their skills not. So I think the sheer restless energy of a lot of young women who, you know, had never had any other opportunities but say cleaning, skivvying work, and to suddenly find yourself in a job where, you know, your intelligence and your emotional skills would be drawn on. And I remember in Nancy Bristow's book on the flu in America, she talks about one particular volunteer who worked at a hospital for 6 days, caught the flu and died. And on her deathbed, apparently that woman said, this has been the best week of my life. So yeah. I was trying to work out how that could possibly be true. What would be so exciting about these few days in a ward of, you know, unpaid, really hard work that would make you say, wow, finally a job that makes me feel important.
Oh, lots of food for thought in that. Emma, it was a wonderful, wonderful book. I mean, I read it in 2 days flat, and I feel for you. I mean, in as much as the pandemic of now has provided an uncanny setting for the launch of this book, it must also have really messed up all plans for its launch and book tours. And I mean, a conversation like this we can do over a screen from continent to continent, but it's not the same as taking your book to your reading public. What's the plan? I mean, are you just sort of looking at it as, we'll do that when we can?
No, it's more like I did it virtually. So yes, and the usual plans would have been, you know, a 2 week tour of big American cities, the ones I always go to, and quite a few cities in Canada, and then Britain and Ireland, maybe a little bit. Instead of that, I have done constant online events all over the world since July. So I'm actually getting, in many ways, more opportunities to reach more people. I wouldn't have been in South Africa. I wouldn't have been in India. And yet I'm managing to do online events to reach those people. So, and even say within a country like America, which is my biggest readership, I'm getting to people who live in rural areas or in areas that are not, you know, part of the usual book tour circuit. So I realize I shouldn't be a snob about this. I mean, face-to-face events are more fun for everyone, but yeah, they were for a relatively selective band who could get to that bookstore that particular evening. Whereas these online events have such a long tail of people who access them online afterwards. So, you know, in many ways, I've probably reached more people through a virtual tour than I could have with a regular one. So I'm not going to complain.
Okay. Final question is, I'm dying to know how the book's been received in Ireland itself, because you take a long and close and not always comfortable look at Irish society, and it may be Irish society of a century ago, but as you say, it's a country that's still grappling with the legacy of some of the issues you describe in this book. What's the response been like in Ireland?
Oh, it's done wonderfully there, and it's on the shortlist for Irish Novel of the Year. You know, in my criticizing of Irish history and Catholic Church in particular, I'm absolutely in the mainstream of Irish novelists. Our job is to speak truth to power and to poke at the sore places in our history. Many other writers, people like, say, Joe O'Connor and Anne Enright, they do the same kind of thing. You know, there's a whole tradition of the Irish writer as the provocateur ever since Joyce. So this is not something that stops Irish people buying my books, far from it. It, I think, keeps me sort of relevant there. So I feel really treasured both by my home country of Ireland and my more recent home country of Canada. I get a lot of attention in both those places. But what's been lovely with this book is that because of the pandemic and because of COVID, I suppose, it's sold far better in places like, say, Australia than I usually would. It's had more of a global reach, I think, because of the COVID factor.